This holiday season, comfort means slowing down and finding calm amid the chaos. Create your natural oasis by prioritizing rest, comfort, and connection with Avocado Green Mattress. As the holidays fill up with gatherings and to-do lists, Avocado mattresses and home essentials provide the foundation for deeper rest, calmer mornings, and a healthier daily routine. Every product is thoughtfully made with the planet in mind, so you can feel good about the comfort and quality you bring into your home. Avocado is better for you and better for the planet. And to make your purchase more accessible, you'll have easy financing options with Affirm. Prioritize rest and recharge with Avocado's organic comfort. Head to avocadogreenmattress.com today to create your natural oasis and save big during their holiday sale. Avocado, dream of better.
Many supplements on the market are hard to absorb or packed with fillers, but that's not the case with Quiksilver Scientific. Quiksilver Scientific is a U.S.-based company that manufactures advanced liposomal supplements, making nutrients easier for your body to absorb and put to work quickly. Made in Colorado in an NSF GMP-certified facility and rigorously tested, this is science-first supplementation. After adding ultravitamin into my routine, recovery feels faster and I don't hit that midday crash anymore. Trusted worldwide for supplements that truly make a difference in performance, resilience, and well-being. Quiksilver Scientific makes advanced liposomal supplements so you can actually feel the difference. Energy, focus, calm, recovery. Get 10% off plus free shipping at tryqs.com/podcast. That's tryqs.com/podcast. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
The old world is dying, the new world struggles to be born. Now is the time of monsters. With those words from Gramsci, I welcome you to the Time of Monsters podcast. I'm Jeet here of The Nation magazine. This podcast is sponsored by The Nation and is widely available on all podcasting platforms and some radio stations as well. So this week, I want to talk about the sort of discussion or conversation about Israel and anti-Semitism that has broken out on the American right in a very fierce way. The immediate provocation was Tucker Carlson interviewing Nick Fuentes. And Fuentes is both a right-winger who wants the United States to cut its ties with Israel, but is also unquestionably, like with massive amounts of evidence, a neo-Nazi, a Holocaust apologist, someone who does not see Jews as being part of America, as well as also, you know, like a racist and a misogynist and an incel and many other things. Now, that interview caused a lot of eyebrows to be raised. I mean, Tucker Carlson has been flirting with far-right anti-Semites for a long time now. But Nick Fuentes is, to some eyes, a bridge too far. Although I'll also mention that, you know, sitting President Donald Trump had dinner with Nick Fuentes in 2022. But this particular conversation or argument really spilled out over into the Heritage Foundation, the very influential think tank, which is really the sort of engine behind Project 2025 and, you know, very instrumental in setting the agenda for the Trump administration. The president of that organization, Kevin Roberts, put out a video, you know, saying that he'll stand by his friend Tucker Carlson, who he said was being attacked by globalists. And this has caused a lot of controversy, a lot of donors, threatening to withdraw money. And then Roberts had to apologize. And then they had a meeting at Heritage, which turned out to be, you know, like something that people on the left might be familiar with, a kind of struggle session, where people were airing their grievances, including especially many young staffers, who might say they disavow Nick Fuentes, but also said that, you know, they're not very keen on Israel and that they have, legitimate reasons. So I think, more than 2 years after the Hamas attack and the sort of violence that we've seen in Gaza, this is really an indication of how much the conversation has changed. But in some ways, there's also maybe a return to an older conversation. There has been a long history of both anti-Zionism and anti-Semitism, sometimes overlapping, sometimes not, on the American right, as well as on the American left. And I think that history is not very well known and it's worth exploring. And I can't think of anyone better to talk about than my guest this week, David Austin Walsh, author of an excellent book, Taking America Back, which is really about the relationship between the mainstream respectable right and the far right. And I think anyone who wants to figure out where right-wing anti-Zionism comes from and the sort of debates that surround it, I think David's book is one of the very few places that it offers a sound grounding. So first of all, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So let's just start with the, you know, I rehearsed this sort of debate at Heritage, but what's your sense of what's going on there and on the broader right, like right now, coming out of, you know, this Nick Fuentes interview?
I mean, there's so much to talk about here. There's so many different dimensions of it. And this is a story that just keeps developing. I mean, I've been looking, I just saw the headline, which I guess came out last night, but I'm just seeing it this morning now, that the anti-Semitism task force severs relationship with the Heritage Foundation. This is in the New York Times. So the National Task Force to Combat Anti-Semitism said that, you know, it will no longer, it apparently no longer wishes to be affiliated with the Heritage Foundation. I mean, what I think is happening, maybe taking a broader step back, I wrote a piece in Boston Review late last month in which I kind of tried to think about where the emerging fissures are within the sort of MAGA coalition. And I spoke in the process of doing that piece to Kurt Mills, who is the CEO of the American Conservative magazine, the Paleocon magazine. Mm-hmm. And one of the things he told me, and I wrote a bit about this in the piece, is that he thought that Israel was going to be the sort of major dividing line. He kept talking about how it would be a major factor in the sort of struggle for succession, once Trump exits the political scene, if he exits the political scene, that this would be a factor in the 2028 sort of primaries. And lo and behold, within 2 weeks, it explodes as the primary fight on the right. And I think it's been very much below the surface, but only barely submerged for at least the past 6 months. I suspect, maybe we won't go too far down this road, but I suspect that the Charlie Kirk assassination kind of propelled this emerging fissure into kind of open warfare. So it's a very kind of unsettled time on the right now. And especially Heritage, which is this, you know, incredibly important, very historically important. It's one of the first major conservative think tanks that's established in Washington, obviously remains incredibly influential into the 21st century. And it really has become in the past 10 years the kind of think tank institutional home for the MAGA movement, for MAGA world, and obviously through Project 2025 and other things, to now have that, you know, basically being in the middle of a civil war within the Heritage Foundation. It's a big deal. It's a big story. There's a reason why this has been, it sort of moved just beyond the conservative media. We're now seeing front page articles in the Washington Post and the New York Times about these very issues. Although one thing that I will say, and as somebody who has written a book on this subject, I do get a little bit frustrated. And I saw this framing in the Times in their story yesterday, that this is, a time for choosing, that these anti-Semites who Buckley purged from the party and the conservative movement in the 1960s are suddenly back. And like, no, that's not, that's always been a myth. That's always largely been a myth. That is the exact wrong framing that takes the story that the conservative movement has told about itself over the years at face value. Because
that's a remarkably powerful myth, especially in the so-called liberal or, mainstream media. And it is something that, your book refutes. I think Sam Tendenhouse's excellent new biography of William Buckley, very strongly refutes, and many other scholars. I would mention Ed Miller with his book on the John Birch Society. There's a real disconnect here between what the best scholarship on the American right shows and the way that this this is presented. So maybe this is a good occasion to sort of step back and actually look at what is the real history of the relationship. And also, going back to the early 20th century, and, there's disputes about this, but I think one way to think about the American right is, and its current form, is to think that it really crystallized in the 1930s in the reaction to the New Deal. There'd obviously been forms of conservatism earlier, big business conservatism, but in terms of an actual reactionary counter-revolutionary movement that wants to roll back, you know, significant social democratic gains, you can only have that once you have the New Deal. And that is really what brings together this movement, which combines a faction of, you know, like older free market or capitalist right with sort of traditionalists who are upset about social liberalism, and certain foreign policy types who were very upset at the sort of anti-fascist direction of Roosevelt's foreign policy. So the right, which I mean, I think scholars call the old right, really coalesced in the 1930s. And so what can we say about those people, and particularly in this case, how they felt about the Jews?
Yeah. So, you know, obviously the 1930s, this sort of new crystallization of, and I mean, one of the things that I've been thinking a lot more about is how to push this story back, trying to think through a new book project, push the story back to the 1890s and the kind of sort of right-wing dimensions of the American populist movement. But definitely there is something that happens in the 1930s, which establishes what I call in my book a kind of right-wing popular front dedicated to opposing, you know, the New Deal coalition. Now, it's interesting. They don't really have a whole lot to say about Zionism. Mm-hmm. Per se, in the 1930s, precisely, certainly anti-Semitism is common on the alt right, and it's a very specific. It's expressed in very specific ways because of the specific political circumstances at the time. It is a anti-Semitism which believes, which holds that, you know, one, it's the New Deal is secretly controlled by Jews. It's the Jew deal. You know, the more, I think, sophisticated version of this, which people like Merwin Hart, who I write about in my book, among others, get into, is that, well, actually, you know, the New Deal coalition is based on appealing to these new immigrant groups, especially Jews, who are, you know, have alien political traditions that are, you know, social democratic or socialist in nature. So there's that dimension. On the foreign policy side, it is the Jews are going to get us into World War II. They're going to get us into a fight with the Nazis, that this is not something that is in American national interest to get involved in. I mean, this is even before the outbreak of World War II, to get involved in any kind of foreign commitment or overseas commitment, particularly on behalf of a, you know, an ethnic constituency in the United States. We're not going to fight Hitler on behalf of, you know, Rabbi Stephen Weiss or, you know, the Anti-Defamation League, that kind of thing. You know, and that continues to be kind of the old right's stance. Really until Pearl Harbor. And obviously this is, you know, most infamously expressed in Charles Lindbergh's speech in Des Moines, Iowa in September 1941, where he basically says that there's a cabal of Jews who are trying to drive the United States into open war with the Nazis. And Lindbergh is obviously an anti-Semite. He's also a committed sort of white supremacist. The first thing he writes after the outbreak of war in 1939 is something for I can't remember if it's Reader's Digest or Life magazine. I think it might be Reader's Digest. But it's basically an essay about how horrible it is that Europe is you know, the white race is fighting itself in Europe. And so, you know, this is the kind of dominant strain of sort of anti-Semitic, or not even necessarily anti-Semitic. I mean, it is obviously anti-Semitic, but the dominant strain of thinking about Jews on the American right until 1945.
And just to like put a, you know, give a sort of put some names and faces to this, you know, the people who thought this way would include H.L. Mencken, you know, who's like one of the most influential political writers of the early 20th century, Albert J. Nock, a hugely influential intellectual, you know, with mainstream audience, writing for the Atlantic Monthly, expressing like all these ideas that Lindbergh also shared. And the other thing that I'd want to flag is that, because I think it's relevant to the contemporary debate, that foreign policy vision, which is that the white racialized view of the global politics, that the white race has to stick together and deal with, you know, what was called the rising tide of colored, the rising tide of non-white people. That, you know, like is not merely of antiquarian interest. I think that is actually the sort of foreign policy vision of someone like Stephen Bannon, right? Like there is a kind of long continuity, and then, you know, certain elements of the MAGA world where they basically want, you know, like a rapprochement with Russia, you know, in Europe, because the real enemy is, you know, China And as we now see, you know, Venezuela, you know, like this is a view of foreign policy that you want to have a settlement with whatever dictator you need to do in Europe so that the United States can take forward its proper task, which is hemispheric domination and expansion into Asia. So I mean, I just wanted to flag that because so listeners understand that this foreign policy, this worldview, you know, has long continuities on the right and persists.
Actually, just to briefly add to that, I mean, one of the things that I think gets under-discussed when thinking about, you know, how Pearl Harbor changes everything and like the isolationist movement in the United States just evaporates after Pearl Harbor, you know, it's not a coincidence that it is the racial war against Japan that kind of leads to that. Like, you know, Lindbergh, I mean, he's not deployed in Europe because the Roosevelt administration doesn't trust his loyalty, but they do send him to the Pacific. He does fight in the Pacific and, you know, fighting the Japanese, who are a racial enemy as well. And I mean, there's been any number of books written about this, most famously, John Dower's War Without Mercy. It makes this possible, this is sort of shift possible as quickly as it happens.
Yeah, and in fact, I mean, like in some ways that isolationist, so-called isolationist impulse, which is really an impulse for hemispheric and Asian domination, it persists, like not just with Lindbergh going after war, but with like the Republican foreign policy during World War II was Asia first, that the United States should be actually fighting in Japan, and that, you know, like fighting Hitler, you know, as always, it remains a kind of secondary thing. And, you know, like this is, obviously this might be a variety of different motives for thinking in that way. But I mean, like certainly in the case of someone like Lindbergh, it is a fact that, you know, like for him, Hitler being overlord of Europe is no bad thing. Like it's actually a useful thing as a bulwark against communism. But coming out of, so I mean, I think it's the important point to underscore is that this, what we mistakenly call isolationist, but the sort of right-wing foreign policy persisted during World War II. And then it took on a kind of like new lease on life after the war. And do you want to kind of like, and where actually the issue of Zionism becomes much more important, because after the war, you know, as a consequence of both the Holocaust, and I would add as a consequence of the unwillingness of the United States and other countries to take Jewish refugees, the you know, the issue of like Israel becomes the issue of Zionism and of trying to create a Jewish state in the Middle East comes to the fore.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's two things that are happening on you know, the old right, or, you know, however we want to define them after World War II, but the old sort of non-interventionist right that emerges very, very quickly in 1945. One is, as you pointed out, there is a real hostility towards admitting refugees from Europe, especially Jewish refugees. I mean, the Displaced Persons Act in 1948, which it allows for the admission of some, relaxation of some of the restrictionist quotas that are put in by the 1924 Immigration Act, is explicitly done so in a way as to exclude Eastern European Jews in favor of the Volksdeutsche, the expellees from Sudetenland, from Poland after the war. So there's that dimension. That's one of the reasons why Robert Taft, I'm getting ahead of myself. The other sort of concern is the way in which the United States may be kind of involved or enmeshed with these emerging post-colonial conflicts in, you know, what is primarily sort of British sphere of influence. So I think that you can look at Robert Taft, the senator from Ohio, as a sort of useful figure here to understand how these tensions are emerging and how they end up being resolved within these circles. So Taft is an isolationist. He's against American intervention in the war before Pearl Harbor, you know, very, very anti-communist. Obviously, he's the namesake of the Taft-Hartley Act, so he's very, very opposed to the New Deal. Ironically enough, he is one of the sort of primary advocates for U.S. recognition of Israel in 1948. And the reasons for this are complicated. On the one hand, he's the senator from Ohio. There is a relatively large Jewish population among his constituents, most of whom are Zionist or at least broadly supportive of U.S. recognition of Israel. But also, You know, if you create a Jewish state, a Jewish ethnostate, a Jewish national home in Palestine, that solves the DP issue. It means that you don't have to admit these displaced persons to the U.S. You can instead shunt them to, you know, the Middle East. And in fact, the British, I think it was it was Ernst Bevin, the British Foreign Secretary. He complained about this repeatedly, I think at one point in public in 1946, that the United States is sort of, by refusing to admit displaced persons, you know, they're essentially making this a problem for the British, and, you know, it ends up metastasizing into the 48 war. So, you know, there's that dimension. You know, the other dimension is, and you see this with people like Merwin Hart, who's a right-wing activist in New York. You see this with Gerald L.K. Smith, who's this was at one point associated with Huey Long, you know, by the mid 1940s, late 1940s is sort of has become a more or less a professional anti-Semite. His primary concern is, well, if we recognize the state of Israel, then we are going to be caught in this endless series of wars between Jews and Arabs, and this is just going to extend American security commitments. And also, you know, this is also part of a Judeo-Bolshevik plot driven from Moscow. So there is this, you know, the 40s are interesting because you have this diminishing, you have the Judeo-Bolshevik conspiracy theory, this idea that Jews are communists and, you know, that Moscow is controlled by communism, or Moscow is controlled by the Jews, diminishing, but it still has a purchase on the far right. And so, you know, they look at the Soviet recognition of Israel as sort of evidence of this broader plot. You know, but there is also, especially in the less extreme circles, a genuine concern that U.S. support for Israel is going to lead to, as I said, it's going to lead to all of these foreign policy commitments, which will undermine American power and prestige and cost American blood and treasure. But also, there are some who are genuinely concerned about the plight of Palestinian Arabs in this sort of new paradigm. You know, the Nakba is not a secret in 1948. Yeah. People are watching it across the world. And, you know, much as is today, even people who are, you know, not particularly ideologically or religiously sympathetic to Arabic Muslims still nevertheless are looking at these at this as an atrocity on a massive scale and sort of reacting accordingly.
Yeah. No, and I would actually mention, I mean, since you mentioned the religious angle, there are also a large number of Palestinian Christians who have had, like, you know, longstanding historical ties with the United States through, like, missionary activity and through, you know, a Christian interest in the, you know, so-called Holy Land, and who, like, you know, are bringing stories. And some of these Palestinian Christians are conservative, like, are politically conservative, are Republicans, and are also voices. So, like, in the context of the late 40s and early 50s, the voices that you're the places where you're most likely to hear about Palestinian dispossession were on the right in, you know, publications like Human Events, or as I mentioned in a recent column, Henry Regnery, you know, like a publisher with coming out of the old right. He starts a publishing company in the late 40s, publishes many of the leading conservatives, you know, the first publisher of William F. Buckley, publishes James Burnham, Wilmore Kendall, but also has a strong line of books about Palestinian dispossession, and often, like, bringing aboard writers that don't share his politics otherwise. Ethel Mamim, a British anti-war, anti-imperialist, anti-fascist activist, publishes a book with Regnery. So there, I mean, there is a very ideologically fluid time, but I want to emphasize that, you know, like, there were different strands of the right, and they did, like, intertwine and overlap. But just as there was this clearly anti-Semitic, you know, Gerald K. Smith, you know, Mervyn Hart type of anti-Semitism, there was also strands on the right that had more legitimate concerns. I would also emphasize, like, among the sort of foreign policy realist, you know, a belief that, you know, like, this was going to alienate Arab populations and would create opportunities for Soviet communism. I mean, I think someone like James Burnham, you know, who's right. like very much a Cold Warrior, former CIA analyst. That was his point of view, and it was a point of view shared, like, you know, widely, like in the CIA, in the State Department. I mean, people like George Kennan, right? Like, this was like, yeah.
Something that I think can often get lost in these, obviously not in this conversation since we're having it, but lost in sort of the broader conversations about Israel, the sort of position of Israel on the American right, is that it's a, and really just in American politics writ large, is that it's a very different, almost a categorically different phenomenon before the Six-Day War, before 1967. Yeah. There's much more skepticism of, even in American Judaism, there's not the same degree of affinity for Israel and Zionism in the 40s and 50s and into the 1960s. You know, there's not the same, I mean, Christian Zionism is not a mass phenomenon really until after the Six-Day War, partly because of the strength of mainline Protestantism that lingers into the 1960s. You don't really see the their displacement as the dominant form of Protestant Christianity by evangelicals until the 70s, but also because of these other factors. You know, I mean, some of the most sort of incisive critics of Israel on really in American life in the 1940s and 1950s are coming from mainline Protestant and Catholic publications. They're not approaching it. I mean, there obviously are anti-Semitic traditions in those areas, but they're not approaching their analysis necessarily from that position. They're thinking through, okay, well, who is who basically is looking out for our Palestinian Christian sort of co-religionists, and you know, obviously as he pointed out, that there's a lot of different ties between these communities and sort of mainline Protestantism in the United States. So yeah, it is a very, very different and much more, I think, critical period of time when it comes to sort of U.S.-Israel relations.
Yeah, yeah. And actually, I mean, now that you mentioned it, one of the, I mean, it might be relevant to like Heritage in particular, but wasn't one of the founders of Heritage a sort of Lebanese Arab, Barodi? But I mean, I know that there were like sort of prominent Arab Christians like in that circle of the emerging conservative movement and around Barry Goldwater. And this guy, I mean, I think sort of National Review, which plays a very big role in your book, is kind of interesting because it is the kind of voice of the sort of right-wing popular front. And it is trying to bring together a lot of these different traditions. William F. Buckley Jr., his father, William F. Buckley Sr., was very much a classic old right figure, you know, counter-revolutionary, admirer of Franco, admirer of Lindbergh, very vocal in his belief that, you know, Jews were like communist and bad for American society. I mean, Buckley, you know, there's a debate to be had to what degree he was able to leave that, that tradition behind. But certainly you look at like the early National Review and, you know, like they are publishing people like Ravello Oliver, you know, who like, you know, is unquestionably like an anti-Semite. I think in 1956, National Review described Israel as the first racist modern state.
You mentioned that in the article. Yeah.
Yeah, which is a kind of startling comment. I see this as someone who's very critical of Israel, but that's just not true. You know, like when I was like, you know, like obviously Nazi Germany, apartheid South Africa, and at that time, the United States of America with Jim Crow. But it is, so National Review had, you know, very much as you had those elements within it, but also had the more realist foreign policy, and also I think some of the libertarian critiques of Zionism.
Yeah, yeah. No, I mean, I think what you're seeing in National Review in the late 50s is, again, it is a popular front. It is a kind of coalition of these various different forces and factors. So you've got Ravello Oliver on the one hand, who's a classics professor at the University of Illinois, who is a committed really throughout his entire public life, and he later becomes obviously a neo-Nazi, but he's a committed biological racist. He's the book review editor at National Review, and he keeps complaining about how, you know, Jews like Ashley Montague, who's an anthropologist, I believe, are, you know, working. He writes this big book in the 50s, sponsored by UNESCO, questioning the biological basis of race. This is the beginning of that kind of Franz Boas. We're moving beyond, you know, race, assuming like Lothrop Stoddard, you mentioned The Rising Tide of Color, that race is a biological reality. And for Oliver, race is a biological reality. It is the driving force of history. It's like Oswald Spengler type stuff. You know, it is a Jewish plot to, you know, try to undermine this basic reality. You know, for somebody like Buckley, on the other hand, especially in the late 1950s, I think that, and this is true for some of the other folks at National Review as a Catholic magazine, less true for people like Burnham as a, you know, ex-Trotskyist, but there is a discomfort, and I think you see it in precisely this way, like Israel is the first racist state, a discomfort. They don't have a problem with racism per se. This is, you know, a year afterwards, he writes the Why the South Must Prevail. And also, which he also explicitly ties to the defense of the British Empire. You know, he says, you know, they're defending against the Mau Mau in Kenya. We have to defend against the civil rights movement in Arkansas.
Yeah.
But what I think is, there is a discomfort with the idea of Jewish power coming from this kind of Catholic perspective. It's not something that remains a through line necessarily throughout, certainly not throughout Buckley's entire sort of public life. But at that moment in time, I'm thinking in particular of a book by Magda Chechir, Christian Supremacy, which was published 2 years ago, which is a sort of history of anti-Semitism in kind of legal thinking in the Christian legal tradition in Europe. So I think that's a big dimension of this discomfort with the idea that there is, you know, actual Jewish power, you know, kind of for the first time, really ever tied to Jewish statehood. But it's something that, you know, that element of the right comes to terms with. And again, I think the Six-Day War has a lot to do with it. Also, for the fact of the matter is that Israel in 1948, in part because of the power of the Judeo-Bolshevik myth, and there are other things going on as well, is still seen by broad swaths of the right as, you know, this socialist state. You know, it's got kibbutzes. It could very easily be, you know, an ally of the Soviet Union, right? But politics in the Eastern Bloc shift pretty dramatically within the next 5 years to, you know, essentially state-sanctioned anti-Semitism and intense anti-Zionism, particularly from Moscow, but not just from there. That allows for, it doesn't happen overnight. It happens gradually over the next 20 years, but a reconfiguration of Israel, as this, you know, pseudo-socialistic state run by Jews to, potential, ally against, you know, Soviet influence in the Middle East. And I think that is the kind of realist transformation, that happens.
Yeah, no, I mean, it is very interesting to see the way that those debates played themselves out, because I think one way that they had framed it was that they saw themselves as defending Western civilization. And there's a question, like, is Israel part of Western civilization, or is it like outside of Christendom?
Even Sam Huntington couldn't make up his mind. I know we're jumping ahead to the 90s, but I was just rereading Clash of Civilizations recently. And, you know, he has his whole, you know, there's the Arab civilization, Muslim civilization, European civilization, but there's a distinction between East and West. You know, Latin America has its own civilization. And he has in a footnote, you know, Israel is this interesting sort of exception because on the one hand, it is very much tied into Western European civilization. On the other hand, it's distinct enough to make it its own distinctive Jewish civilization, but it's also more or less aligned with the West. Israel has always kind of occupied this liminal space in this kind of civilizational imagination. Even Pat Buchanan in his book, I believe it was Death of the West, the one where he talks about demographic breakdowns and whatnot. I mean, he writes particularly for him, writes pretty sympathetically about Israel because he sees it as essentially having the same problems vis-a-vis Arab Muslims as the U.S. does in, you know, the 90s and early aughts with Hispanics.
Yeah, Latinos. Yeah, yeah. I mean, that does actually get to the sort of heart of it. And it is interesting. I mean, in Suicide of the West, Burnham has a very interesting sort of paragraph where he's like, you know, how do we sort out this anomaly of Israel? Is it part of the West? Is it not? And I would also mention there's a very interesting correspondence between the philosopher Leo Strauss, who's a sort of conservative, but a bit anomalous from this sort of Christian tradition. Mm-hmm. Obviously, you know, like admiring the ancients and being a religious skeptic, and with Wilmer Kendall of National Review, they had a correspondence mm-hmm. in the late 50s where Strauss basically says, you know, like, I really enjoy National Review, except that you guys are always attacking, like, Israel. Like, why are you doing this? And Strauss's argument with Kendall is, like, you know, like, what you have to understand is that Israel is an outpost of Western civilization. It is spreading Western civilization in the Middle East and is defending Western interests in the region, which I thought was a very shrewd argument to make. And it is the case, and this, you know, brings us to the sort of Six-Day War, where you know, you have a bunch of different developments. One is that, you know, Israel shows its sort of military prowess, and it shows its military prowess at the time where, you know, the United States is bogged down in Vietnam, where, you know, like the spectacle of an American aligned nation like being able to thwart its enemies is like very much, you know, a shot in the arm. And also, you know, as you said, reconfigures the Jewish feelings towards Israel in the diaspora, where, you know, in America, you know, it sort of solidifies the idea that, you know, this project can work and we have to be aligned with it. And more importantly, brings over one of the consequences is transforming a lot of former Cold War liberals into moving further on the right. So it's one of the agents of that. And many of those people were, you know, as it happened, former students of or interested in the work of Leo Strauss. So it's like, you know, the story we were telling, like, it all kind of, you know, converges on that 67 moment. And that is the moment where, yeah, a lot of, not the whole right, but the large elements of, especially the mainstream right, do kind of think like, yes, Israel is the way to go. And it reawakens Christian Zionism of the dispensationalist form. Like, you know, like, yes, you know, we really are going to see an apocalyptic war that will bring back Jesus Christ. The only proviso I'd add to that is I do actually think, like, when we're thinking about Christian Zionism, I wish that there was, like, you know, like, we need to map up more the sort of various strands of it. Like, because there's, like, many older traditions that are just like a sort of providential view of history or seeing, you know, the Holy Land as being historically important. And that has, you know, long had a role among not just evangelicals, but there are even like liberal Protestants who had that kind of Christian Zionism. I think the more controversial form, you know, which is this sort of, you know, dispensationalist, like, you know, like, yeah, we actually need the state so that, you know, like, you know, the world can end.
And also added to that is that, you know, Christian Zionism, and I'm not using that term just in the kind of narrow sense of contemporary politics. When we think about Christian Zionism, you know, there's a method of analysis, there's a sort of framework that we can push that back to really the beginnings of the American Republic in the 18th and early 19th centuries. I mean, you know, you see this, you know, with Anglo-Israelism in Britain as well, this idea that, you know, the United States is the new Jerusalem, that in some meaningful sense, what we're, you know, Americans are the new Jews in this kind of new covenant with God. And, you know, people who believe in that, people who are committed to that kind of vision in the early 19th century are also going to Palestine. They are going on, trips to the Holy Land. You know, there's a tremendous amount of interest in the 19th century around travelogues, to the Holy Land in for American audiences. And I mean, there's been a lot of work on kind of the origins of American Islamophobia. And, you know, a lot of that's tied into the encounter, not so much with Jews in the land of Palestine, but with Palestinian Muslims and even Palestinian Christians to a certain extent, but this kind of savage, barbaric, I mean, this is all the Said Orientalist approach, which I think is all true. So, you know, that is also informing Christian Zionism as it emerges as a new political force after the Six-Day War.
Just to recommend listeners, I think one historian who's written about this is Samuel Goldman.
I was about to say, actually, his book is fantastic on this exact subject.
God's Country. So, mm-hmm. So this sort of broader Christian Zionism. But I mean, I think Christian Zionism, it is a very Protestant phenomenon. I think that they always, like, among Catholic circles.
I was going to say that's actually something that we can see emerging in real time right now on the right, because I was just reading I think it was a report by one of the reporters at National Review about the splits at the Heritage Foundation. And one of the things that's happening is that you have all of this pressure directed against Kevin Roberts by senior members of the Heritage Foundation, by donors who tend to be, you know, older and wealthier on the one hand, and junior staffers on the other, who have been essentially supporting him and saying, you know, what Tucker said, certainly what Tucker said, I might, you know, disavow Fuentes, but what Tucker said should be well within bounds. We should be questioning the U.S.-Israel relationship. And at least a couple of them framed this as, I am a Catholic convert, or I am an Orthodox Christian, and I think that Christian Zionism is a heresy. Because there is not the same kind of dispensationalist tradition in Catholicism Orthodoxy.
Absolutely. And in fact, I mean, you know, there are very old Christian communities inside Israel proper who tend to be Catholic and Orthodox, who have had many problems with, like, the Jewish state, you know, who, like, you face real oppression there. I think what you're referencing is, I mean, there's a very interesting exchange between a young female staffer at this sort of struggle session at Heritage, and she basically said, like, for her, Christian Zionism is a heresy, and also she mentioned the non-interventionist. So you can definitely see, and I think part of this is also at a place like, you know, there has been this sort of trend towards Catholicism on the right. Like, I don't know how much of it is a social media phenomenon, but you'd really, there is a lot more sort of talk of trad caths and some very prominent conversions. And in general, I mean, especially among the sort of more intellectual organizations like Heritage, I'm sorry, Protestants just don't read books. The people who are the more intellectual Catholics, intellectual Christians tend to be Catholics and increasingly Orthodox.
You're baiting me, who is a cultural Catholic, into saying bad things about American Protestantism on this podcast, and I'm not going to take the bait. But I do think that you're right. That you had evangelical Protestantism, and I agree. In theological terms, I mean, you know, they have their own theology, but I've never found it to be particularly sophisticated based on their particularly understandings of biblical literalism. But, you know, you do have, I think, in the driver's seat that has cultural cachet on the right now, traditional Catholicism, you know, various forms of orthodoxy, certainly not a revival of mainline Protestantism, but evangelical. But the other thing to sort of underline here as well is, and this is a point that Kurt Mills brought up with me, that if you actually look at the polling numbers, even among evangelical Christians, even among areas where Christian Zionism has been, you know, the absolute bedrock of the faith for, you know, 40, 50 years, support for Israel is declining pretty precipitously there too. You know, this is a broader phenomenon than just the Catholicization of the sort of intellectual right, which I do think is a real phenomenon, is happening. But it's not, even among evangelicals, this support is softening.
Yeah, no, I think that's absolutely the case. I mean, I think that, like, for broader evangelicals, it was always, I think people who are outside of Protestantism overemphasize the theological commitment. And I think it was a more broadly cultural thing. Like, they read the Bible, and they, you know, obviously places like Jerusalem and Gaza are, like, resonate for these cultural reasons. And they do see themselves as the inheritors of this tradition, and therefore are, you know, broadly sympathetic. But, you know, like, that is not quite, like, thinking, like, this is this project of Israel is theologically necessary, which is really only the belief of like, you know, the dispensationalists, who are like a small minority. And you know, I mean, this is a bit of a digression, but there's like a hilarious dispensationalist preacher who, like, I saw a clip of on YouTube saying that, well, you know, he thinks that, like, you know, God is responsible for the death of Charlie Kirk because Charlie Kirk was developing doubts about Israel, and so God said, you know, like, we have to preserve this innocent man.
I don't think it's as much of a tangent as you might think, because this also gets into the Charlie Kirk assassination conspiracy theories, which are all about how, you know, the Mossad took him out because he was softening on Israel, and this actually is a perfect illustration of just how porous those boundaries are with Christian Zionism. You know, you know, where you have on the one hand somebody saying, well, God took him out because God said, what is the line that John Hagee always says, that, you know, God said, I will bless those who bless Israel and curse those who curse Israel. It's in, I believe, Genesis, or one of the early books of the Bible.
Yeah.
And, you know, that is, you know, there's a very, very fine line between saying God killed Charlie Kirk because he's against Israel and, you know, the Mossad took him out because he's against Israel. And you know, and I do think that that actually is part of the explanation for why young evangelicals are more open to the Groiper stuff, to the Fuentes stuff, because, that you know, there is already a language there that primes them for this.
Yeah, no, no. I mean, the sort of the rise of sort of a conspiratorial culture, you know, in the context of which is like very longstanding, like anti-Semitic conspiracy theories that are out there. And I mean, the river on this stuff like runs very deep. I was actually just watching a video of Joseph Sorbern, who had been a National Review editor in the from the 70s to early 90s, and who ran into, you know, was a controversy because he became more vocally both anti-Semitic and anti-Zionist. On that video from the late 80s, he is talking about, you know, various Christian Arabs that have been killed in the United States, and, you know, like strongly implying that these might have been assassinations. So that strain of thinking has been there for a long time. Now, where I want to maybe like end on this, I think we can talk about this for hours.
God, we really could.
I think for the left in particular, there's some dilemmas here, some things that we have to grapple with, because on the one hand, for anyone who wants, you know, justice for the Palestinians, like, you know, the breakup of that iron grip, a blank check for Israel among both parties, like, you know, that's all to the good. And there are, as I mentioned before, like strands within conservative thought on this issue that I think the left would do well to attend to. I especially think that the arguments along the lines of national interest, which have been made by conservatives in the past, have like some, or, you know, like about the alienating effect that America supports Israel has, like, both in, not just in the Middle East now, but like all over the world.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
I mean, these are like really serious considerations. Worth engaging with. But conversely, there is, like, you know, like there are these other powerful strands, which are Nick Fuentes, which are, I think, can be accurately and without hysteria characterized as neo-Nazi thinking. So how do you grapple with that?
Right. So, I mean, it's a really, really important question. I was just listening to, I think I might have mentioned it before, I was just listening to the On the Nose podcast from Jewish Currents. We're grappling with this very question because Ariel Angel was saying on there that she was listening to the Fuentes interview. And to be clear, for the listeners who have not actually sat down and listened to the Fuentes Tucker interview, which, I mean, don't, because it's 2.5 hours long and they, you know, but Fuentes does come across as much more reasonable and much more rational than he does on his actual show. He doesn't talk. He doesn't make his comments about rape and how, you know, sex with women is gay and all of the other weird stuff that he says.
Yeah.
You can cut that out for broadcast purposes.
But
he does come across as much more sort of sober and reasonable. And what Ariel Angel was saying is that, well, you know, a lot of the stuff that he says about the U.S.-Israel special relationship and about the way in which it is considered impolitic in sort of officialdom to question it is not wrong. And so the problem then becomes, okay, well, how do we attend to that critique without opening up space for this kind of, again, I think gutter neo-Nazism. And for me, the way to do that, and this is something that the left is especially well positioned to do, is through the language of universalism. Mm-hmm. I mean, the reason why Fuentes is an anti-Semite, at least in the context of the Tucker interview, is pretty clear cut. He says that he believes in nationalism, that he's a strong ethno-nationalist, and kind of the basis of his grievance against Israel is that, well, it's a Jewish ethno-state that is exercising this influence over the United States. Why do the Jews get their ethno-state and we white Christians don't get our ethno-state here? You know, he's only able to express himself and his politics through that kind of language. The left, at least the vast majority of the left, and hopefully many liberals as well, I'd say this is a core conceit of liberalism as a political philosophy and ideology, yeah. is universalism. It is the principle that there is a universal human dignity, universal human equality. Yes, there are groups. Yes, there are differences between ours, you know, but we are all entitled to fundamental universal rights. And it is that language of universalism that I think that is what separates left critiques of Israel from these sort of right wing ethno-nationalists. I agree that, you know, the language of national interest is potentially useful, but it is something that I think the left needs to approach with some degree of caution for precisely this reason, because that language of national interest can be very easily co-opted into the language of particularism.
I think that's a good point. I mean, when I said the language of national interest, I do actually mean like this is like a non. This is something that's outside the left. It's a non-left tradition, but it's something worth grappling with. It is an actual serious view of the world that one has to take seriously. But I mean, you know, it is absolutely the case. I mean, I think universalism offers a way. And in some ways, I think the Nick Fuentes stuff also underscores the importance of actually talking about Israel and of making that universal case, because unless you make that case, you're leaving this, like, you know, huge important issue, which is tearing people apart, you know, across the political spectrum. You're leaving it to the Nick Fuentes of the world to capitalize on it, which is a very dangerous situation.
Yes, I agree.
It's almost like imperative that unless you present that left universalism as an alternative, then we're going to head to a very dark place very quickly.
But I will add to this that, I mean, I do think that that was what. Because the other thing they talked about on The Nose, and it's a podcast appearance that I've also listened to, is Norm Finkelstein on Candace Owens' podcast.
Yes.
And I do think that that was an attempt to offer a kind of, obviously, Finkelstein's a left-wing anti-Zionist, a child of Holocaust survivors himself, and, you know, was trying to do that. But I think Owens in particular, because of how... much more so than Fuentes, how unhinged she came across in that interview. That was not, what that kind of engagement needs to look like. But I do think that the language of national interest, being strategic about what the actual goals here are, which is, you know, I would say, I mean, you know, broadly speaking, the cessation of violence in Gaza in the immediate sense. I mean, obviously there's the ceasefire, but it's very tenuous. Longer term, the dismantling of obviously the apartheid state and some kind of restorative justice there that can be done, through the language of national interest. It is in the American national interest, I think, to cease to give unqualified and unreserved support to Israel. But that has to be tied to that sort of broader universalist and emancipatory vision.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think we're very much in agreement. And on that, I think that's a very positive note. I want to end and thank my guest, David Austin Walsh, for being on the program.
All right. Thank you so much, Gene. This has been fun.